Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Ezra Klein. The election is just days away, and obviously, I think you would probably like us to tell you who is going to win, but we don't know.
Should listen to my EK show with Nate Silver.
Yeah, so does he tell you what's the TLDR?
Biden, absolutely. Right? The thing that Nate believes is that you can predict things in the future with certainty and you don't need to worry about messy probabilities.
Thank God. I have had enough of probability distributions.
I should not speak for Nate, but I would say that as a longtime reader and listener of his, I feel like I can tell when he is trying to tell you that the conventional wisdom about who will win is wrong and like you really need to like pivot in the other direction. And when he's trying to tell you that if you believe the numbers, like one candidate looks likelier than the other. And I feel like 2016, he was like really raising the alarm of Donald Trump can win. And this year he does not have that same edge to his voice, which is not to say that he does not think Donald Trump can win. He obviously thinks that is possible, but we talk a lot about how 2016 and 2020 are different, and it's pretty clear to me from that conversation that he thinks, and the numbers do show, Biden to be in a stronger 2020 position.
Yeah, so all kidding aside, because I knew you had that on the docket, I decided to not make this you and me BSing about this, because I think we are both Nate Silver readers and fans, and he's just there in person to tell you. So, you know, what we're going to do instead is try to reflect back on some of what we've learned over the past 4 years, what we've experienced. So we came up with three questions that we wanted to talk about. You know, what have we changed our minds about over the past 4 years? What surprised us about the campaign? And what kind of policy issue do we wish we had the chance to cover more and maybe think about more during the Trump years? So let's just start it out. Like, number one, what have you changed your mind about?
So this is not going to be shocking to Weeds listeners, but it is still big to me. I have changed my mind about what kind of behavior the American public, or at least a substantial portion of it, will accept in political leaders, what kind of behavior elected politicians will choose to defend or look the other way on, how weak our systems of automatic accountability or even reliable accountability really are, and thus, in some macro sense, how undefended our political system really is. I think if I look back to 2016 and I think about why did I underestimate Donald Trump's strength despite his, you know, lead in the polls for much of that primary. The simplest reason is that he acted in ways that I believed would ultimately turn enough people off that he wouldn't win. That there was some kind of bar in American politics and that he was beneath it in the way he comported himself, the way he treated other people, the way he talked about politics, the way he showed his own mind to work. And that exposed to that for a length of time, like I believed enough in my fellow residents of this country, that he would be rejected. And there are ways in which that's true. He's been a consistently unpopular leader. He's never won an election with a majority of the vote. But it was fundamentally untrue. And Trump was lionized for it by a substantial portion of the population. And then what you really saw behind that was a way that partisan polarization then like locked the Republican Party in place behind him. And I've said this on the show many times, but the degree to which that should make one afraid of a savvier, more strategic version of Donald Trump, I think cannot be overstated. So just my simple view about there being a kind of bar of decency and just functional comportment and like obvious stability that you need to clear to be taken seriously in American politics is gone. And my belief that parties will act in any kind of responsible fashion if somebody manages to come in from the outside who doesn't clear those bars is gone. So like I'm much more pessimistic about the long-term future of the American political system than I was a couple of years back.
You know what really struck me about that? You know, thinking back to where my head was 4 years ago, was how little difference it made that all kinds of, frankly, not subtle elite signals, like, were in fact blaring during the 2016 campaign, like, that Trump couldn't get, like, Republican ex-presidents to speak on his behalf at his convention, that, you know, George Will thought he was terrible, that, you know, I mean, I it's not like I ever thought that, like, everybody sits on the edge of their seat waiting to see what George Will columns will say. But I used to feel like if you paid attention to elite sentiment, that that would either causally or just correlationally, like, tell you something important about what was going on. And it really didn't. Right? Like, through some mix of people not caring, the intermediating institutions and the media not really caring or framing it correctly. I mean, it's very important that, like, Fox News did not portray the question of, like, Donald Trump's fitness as something that conservatives disagreed about seriously. But yeah, I mean, it was a weird one.
There are some sub themes in that. And obviously, this is a very big part of what my book on polarization is about. But I was struck over and over again that oftentimes when Republican elites would challenge Donald Trump frontally or indirectly, they would lose the challenge. And I always believe that the signal moment of the primary and the signal moment for understanding the modern right came when Fox News actually did try to challenge Donald Trump. So if you think back to 2016, there is, I believe it is the first Republican primary debate. And Fox News puts up its, like, more respectable journalist group. So Chris Wallace, Megyn Kelly, and Bret Baier. And, like, whatever you think about them individually, like, that's a crew who, like, they're conservative, I think, in their personal politics, but they want to be taken seriously as journalists. And it's clear at that moment that a decision had been made that, like, they were going to let the air out of this Trump thing. And so he really gets tagged by them. I mean, really tough questions. Megyn Kelly reading back misogynistic things he said. Other Fox News, other ones of the hosts, I think it was Wallace, like, really asking about non-conservative positions Trump has taken. And Trump and Fox News go to war for about a week and a half. And just Trump wins. Megyn Kelly is out at the network a year later. Tucker Carlson is brought in after Bill O'Reilly goes down to be like a more Trumpist figure there. Then the then living Roger Ailes sort of like makes peace with Donald Trump. And Fox News becomes like the pro-Trump propaganda network. But I think so many people have a view and an understanding of Fox News as like a truly capable actor in Republican Party politics. And I think it's no doubt important. But also, they are also in hock to the conservative base and its anger and its resentments and its fears and its concerns and its desires. And when they created something that went beyond them and spoke more directly to that base than they did, Fox News ended up bending the knee and became a more Trumpist network. I mean, the network today looks quite different than it did 4 or 5 years ago. The things Tucker Carlson talks about and focuses on, you know, the compromises he's willing to make and not willing to make are different than what we used to think Fox News was. And so, like, yeah, even Fox News, like, I actually think the power of the base is much stronger than I would have given it a couple of years ago. And that was particularly true after 2012, when it looked like, you know, you had this sort of party decides thing happened that got Mitt Romney in over all these more base-associated characters. That just turned out to be true for that election, not true for the next one. But yeah, even Fox News, right? Like, they do not have full range of motion. Like, they there is something happening in the Republican Party that is a little bit independent, I think, of the actors and the institutions, and keeps pulling them to the right, even as it's more legible to see the way they then go to the right.
Speaking of 2012, that comes to my surprise, which was change of mind, which was about Republicans and Latino voters, where, you know, I went back and I looked at my official 2012 election take for Slate, where I was working at the time. And I was trying to like pump the brakes a little bit on like the moral of this story is that Republicans need to be easier on immigration to win Latino voters. But even in that context, I was still saying, look, you obviously can't deal with an increasingly diverse America by saying to a huge population of people that you believe their presence in the country is a threat to the basic integrity of the country. And, you know, Trump comes along and he wins. And, you know, we all have our reasons for why he wins. But the extent to which, and you really see this in the polling now, that over the past few years, as Trump's overall level of support has gone down, his level of Latino support has gone up. And, you know, there's a bunch of different explanations for that. People look at it and they, you know, delve into the sort of micro elements of the demographic. But I just think it's important to note, I mean, for me personally, but I think for a lot of people, that the sort of like big picture view that most of us had about the relationship of the immigration issue to the Latino electorate was just not really true at all. Pretty, I mean, it's like the opposite of the 2012 GOP autopsy report, not just in terms of like the direction Trump took, but ultimately in terms of what kinds of voters he's able to gain there. And on one level, it's maybe not the biggest deal in the world. It's not that many people. It's not inexplicable by any means. Everybody always knew this is a diverse community. A lot of different issues matter. But I feel like there was some pretty firm and hard conventional wisdom that I was bought into that has really sort of not panned out.
And so you gestured this a little bit, but I know you've looked at a lot of the data on this. What do you think it is that is leading to rising Trump support among Hispanics? Like, what is it policies? Is it temperament? Is it how the economy was doing before? Like, how do you see? I don't think what's working is specifically the anti-immigration demagoguery. So, like, what is working?
You know, I think that there's sort of three horns to it. One is a sort of a Cuban-specific phenomenon, which is that younger Cuban voters had been maybe trending toward Democrats for a while, and there was a sort of backlash against the perception that Trump was racist and anti-Latino. He has really just like mended fences with the Cuban community. There was an interesting profile, I think it was in the Times, but there's like a very prominent young Cuban-American YouTuber who is very popular with both the Cuban and Venezuelan community. And Democrats, younger Democrats in particular, embrace of the label of socialism has been damaging, I think, with that particular segment of the electorate. But what I hear from pollsters, from politicians working in Texas and Arizona, most fundamentally is just actually really similar to what you heard about working class white voters, you know, not just like in 2016, but the kind of like long arc of that demographic slipping away from Democrats, which is just that like there's a fair amount of conservative cultural views, particularly about gender norm stuff, and to some extent about guns and other kinds of things there. And it's not exactly that, you know, immigration is just not as important, I think, to Latino citizens as Democrats who constructed, you know, a group framework sort of wanted it to be, right? It's not that, like, Trump's position on immigration is super popular with Latinos. If it was, he'd be doing even better. But it's that the general sort of culturally conservative worldview, which if you just think about Latin America, right, like lots of culturally conservative politicians do well in Latin America. And it's the same thing with people who, you know, are Latin American immigrants or their children and grandchildren, particularly people who haven't gone to college and thus are not acculturated into the kind of broader progressive worldview.
Let me ask you one other question that I think flows from that, which is you'll sometimes hear rhetoric like, well, like after Trump, the GOP is destroyed for a generation among X, right? Like after Trump, like the GOP is never going to rebuild among young voters. Because, I mean, one thing you really see is like the GOP's numbers among young voters are wild these days. It's, you know, like they went to a first approximation, like nobody under 30. But something that is in that kind of, I think, somewhat surprising shift in Trumpist support since 2016 is that in reality, in the groups that people often thought would be the most difficult for Trump to make gains with, he's actually made some gains. And in the groups that you would have thought it most difficult for Democrats to make gains with, they've made some gains. So is it just a case that, you know, Joe Biden, let's say Joe Biden wins the election in a couple of days and then, you know, whatever, either whatever happens in 2024 happens, that just if the Republicans in a two cycles just nominate a good candidate, that it's like everything with Trump is forgiven and the slate gets wiped clean? Like, do you think there's a lock-in of brand that will affect the party going forward? Or do you think that politics and political coalitions are just much more fluid candidate to candidate and cycle to cycle than the conventional wisdom would have you believe?
I mean, it seems like there's a lot of fluidity, right? I mean, you remember after 2008, right? Like, I mean, George W. Bush really screwed up. And like, the country was
not a good precedent.
The country was in a sorry state, you know, at that point in time. And Democrats, they won a much sort of broader victory than I think even looks like it's on the table, just in terms of the geographical scope. But it really did not take them long to bounce back. And some of that was they brought in this incredibly intense racial polarization, right? That, I mean, I was now saying Trump, in a weird way, took us away from. But like Obama was not a president who tried to be a polarizing figure on racial topics. I mean, very much the opposite. But you know, he was, or the conservative reaction to him was, things change very rapidly, right? I think the biggest problem that Republicans have is that if you look at where the sort of like millennial like age bulge is, right? So it's like, I'm like the oldest millennial, but people like you, a few years younger than me, are much more numerous, right? There's like just like a ton of people who are approximately your age and are aging into like peak voting and stuff like that. So like Republicans have a lot of ground to make up, you know, so it's like even marginal gains don't help you if your voters die and other people start turning out at higher levels. But it's been amazing to me to see compassionate conservatism, then Tea Party libertarianism, then whatever Trump's populism is, like with honestly, a lot of policy continuity between them, but like completely different branding and affect, and everybody just sort of like buys into it. So I don't know. I mean, the future is hard to predict.
All right, let's take a break and then go to what has surprised us.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society.
Like, imagine a world without hot sauce or barbecue sauce or Worcestershire sauce or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So I think what is, I want to say what is different about this question than what have we changed our minds on is that these are things where I didn't have an incredibly strong view going in, but just something like took me aback. And I don't know if you want to go first here, Matt, but or I should do mine.
Well, here, let me do. We'll switch the orders. I have just been, my mind has been blown. I mean, exactly as you were saying, I didn't have like an opinion of like, what will the impact on public opinion be of a global pandemic? But as I keep watching things unfold in like American politics of the Trump years, I'm just like, I keep being surprised by the stasis in the polling, you know? By how, it's such a cliche, like, it feels like the news has been so busy. But when you, like, try to look back on the numbers, it's just like nothing happened, which is actually quite different from the Bush years, right? Where public evaluation of him, you know, was a roller coaster. And even Obama, who had more stable ratings, it felt in the Obama time that it was like, well, he started popular because of hope and change. Then his numbers kind of cratered because the economy didn't get that much better. And then he just kind of crept up as time went on. And that felt right. It felt like it was tracking events in the world. This Trump stuff, man, it's like what's going on? Like why have we produced all this journalism and everybody else? Like, what is this all for? Like, if nobody cares or has their minds open to being changed about anything, including him not getting credit for the economy being good when the economy was strong, like, it's just, it makes me feel nihilistic, you know, like in an uncomfortable way.
So now that I remember what yours was, I'm glad we did yours first, because this was also my first choice for this question, but you had taken it, so I couldn't have it too. But I do want to talk about it. So one, I just cannot agree more. I wrote a whole book about how polarization locks Americans in political place and creates a politics devoid of like accountability. And I still would have predicted, if you had told me about the year to come, that there would have been a pretty sharp change in the polls. What I would not have predicted, this is, I wrote this piece that I'm going to quote from now on September 2nd. So, but it's a pretty similar situation right now. But a year before, Trump had a 41.3% approval rating and a 54% disapproval rating in 538. So that was like it at the beginning of September in 2019. And then during the 365 days that followed, 200,000 people died. Unemployment went to 10.2%. We banned travel. Like, also, Trump got impeached during this period. He like gassed
Which was
protesters.
His high point.
Right, he gassed protesters in Lafayette Park. And at the end of all of that, he was at 42.2% approval and 54.3% disapproval. So his approval went up a point, and his disapproval stayed functionally the same. Like, that's crazy. And then on the other hand, what I did like this big piece on it. I'll put it in show notes. But the thing about Trump was that he had really, really, really gotten people to make up their minds about him. And the part of it that's scary to me is not like, you know, the people who would not say they approve of Trump, even though he's doing an okay job, you could argue on the economy because they're just not going to approve of somebody who's a racist. Because I agree with that position, it's very intuitive to me. But it's like, how about if you like thought Trump was doing a good job on the economy and then he totally flubbed coronavirus? And like one of the answers appears to be that a lot of those folks live in an informational universe where he didn't flub coronavirus. But not everybody's watching Fox News. And so then like another possibility seems to simply be that it is, if you want Trump to win the next election because you just like don't like the Democrats, you have like a really powerful psychological reason to like discount evidence that he's doing a bad job. And then like a third argument is actually that he really has paid for handling coronavirus badly, because if you look at a number of other world leaders and a number of governors, their approval ratings have gone up dramatically, but he has not. He's gone, if anything, a little bit down at this point. And so he's not gotten the bump other people got. And so like maybe in fact that the intuitions of the public are to give leaders a lot of credit for what they're doing, even if they're not doing that good of a job. Like Andrew Cuomo got a big bounce despite handling this badly at the beginning. But you really see Trump's mistakes here in the fact that he didn't go up where so many other people like had like a really, really big rally around the leader effect. So maybe he's paying more against the counterfactual than like one might imagine. And like Jeb Bush would have done a good job and be cruising a re-election right now. But it is unsettling, I would say.
Well, plus just like all the scandals, right? Like, do you remember when George W. Bush was president and he got reelected, and then early in his second term, he like tried to get rid of a bunch of U.S. attorneys in order to replace them with like people who were going to be more partisan, which is like within his constitutional powers of office, but like was considered an inappropriate way to behave. And that was like a big story, you know, just like on its own, like the U.S. attorney scandal, like it was like a whole thing. And there was also a big moment in the Bush years where he was seen as having mishandled a hurricane response. So like both of those things happened in the Trump years, and like nobody even thinks about them anymore. Right. It's like, you know, you look at any one thing and you could be like, well, it's odd that this impeachment thing didn't really hurt him. If anything, it helped him. Or it's odd that he didn't really go down in the pandemic. But it's like everything, you know, there's just like such incredibly powerful equilibrating forces that like I guess we chalk up to polarization. But it's weird. It's like, you know, it's not like we didn't have polarization in Obama's first term.
But there is some evidence there's actually something similar that happened with Obama. Like if you look at Obama's approval ratings against what you would predict from the economy, he's much more stable than past presidents had been under similar conditions. Just not as stable as Trump.
I know. I mean, it's just an incredible like step change, you know. But it is true right now. If you go back and look, so 538 has a good like historical approval thing. You look at evaluations of George H.W. Bush and it's like, man, it's a wild ride. You know, it's
so like, there is an interesting argument on this, that one reason Bush could go so far down in his second term, which did not happen in the first term. I mean, even though Iraq was a disaster, he still has like very, very strong Republican support. And so this is something some political scientists argued to me while I was doing this piece, but is that partisans are willing to give up on a president who is term limited out, because it's actually arguably helpful to do so. Like, yeah, he was bad, but like elect John McCain because John McCain's great. And it's actually becomes like some of the polarizing dynamics switch their valence. So like if Donald Trump won re-election and like kept fucking everything up, he might actually be able to go lower in a second term, because Republicans wouldn't need people to like Donald Trump to keep power. They could actually try to switch people's allegiance to Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or somebody.
Well, and I guess psychologically, right? Like if you, I mean, because right now it's like some people are just highly committed to not voting for Democrats. And it's hard to say to yourself, well, I'm going to vote for a terrible president.
Right.
Like to keep the Democrats out of power. But if Trump wasn't literally on the ballot, you could say, yeah, he's terrible, but I'm voting for, you know, whoever. Because
right.
I like him and I want to keep Joe Biden out. Whereas now it's like it's too much dissonance.
Right.
But still, it's like, I don't know. I mean, it's just one of these things that makes me wonder. So what's yours? What's your surprise?
So mine is actually on the flip that... By the same token, I expected the way Joe Biden's campaign to go would be more subject to polarizing dynamics than it actually has been. So Something that I anticipated was that Joe Biden's relatively solid approval ratings would go down once he became the general election nominee and there was a sort of unified attack on him. Like, there was a, if you think back to the Democratic primary, there's actually a lot of semi-positive coverage of Joe Biden on Fox News and even in Donald Trump tweets, because like what they were trying to do and say is that like, oh, the Democratic Party has an opportunity to like nominate a moderate normal guy in the tradition of its past nominees, but instead they're going to go with crazy Bernie or Elizabeth Warren or something. And so there was like a lot of this like three-dimensional chess thing happening. But then, of course, Joe Biden wins the nomination, so they can't do that anymore. So all of the attacks on the right turn on Joe Biden and his approval rating goes up. And he's actually gotten more popular during this period. And then just a bunch of other things he's doing, right? Joe Biden has run, if you read, say, oh my God, what is the name of Identity Crisis, the Sides Vavrick Tesler book on 2016, they have all this data showing that one reason that Trump ends up winning is he just dominates the media, right? He just sucks up all the oxygen. Even when the coverage is negative, he's the only guy getting covered. And so one like takeaway that a lot of people have from that is that like this is now the right strategy in American politics. Like, even if you're going to make people mad, make sure you are setting the terms of the debate. And Joe Biden just doesn't. He runs this kind of quiet, more inoffensive campaign. He's very focused, as far as I can tell, not on giving people reasons to vote for him, but on not giving them reasons to vote against him. Like, I think Joe Biden's campaign is best understood as an attempt to defang negative partisanship, not as an attempt to harness positive partisanship. Like, he's letting Donald Trump be the mobilizing force to turn out Democrats, but he does not want to be an equal and opposite force to turn out Republicans. And look, the election's in a couple days. We don't have the results yet. But as best as I can tell, this has been successful. And Joe Biden, in running this campaign that sort of like defies like all post 2016 Democratic punditry, except for maybe the idea that like, you know, white guys are safer nominees, which is a very unfortunate theory that came out in 2016. But like, other than that, like, Joe Biden does not create an equal and opposite policy agenda. He does not generate a kind of like left populist force. He is not an assault on the establishment. He does not try to dominate the media. He does not try to win Twitter fights. He does not try to like exhibit his level of anger about the Republican Party. Like, just like nothing. He does not focus on like the things resistance Twitter or even resistance Democratic Party figures are into. Like, he's a central figure in what becomes the impeachment issue. But he doesn't really run on that at all, like to the extent, even less so than other candidates in there whose sons are not at the center of like the effort Donald Trump was making to investigate. And it all just kind of works. And so I think the success of Biden's campaign for me is surprising. I don't find him an inspiring figure on the stump, but it works for people. And I think there's a lot worth rethinking. You know, that may be distinct to running against Donald Trump, but understanding correctly what the dynamics of the person you're running against are and like harnessing that is like correct strategic thinking. And so, yeah, so Biden's success and the fact that so far he's been more successful than I would have anticipated in avoiding some of the polarizing dynamics and not running polarizing strategies is a surprise to me.
Biden's relationship with the left has gone a lot better than Hillary Clinton's did, right? So Hillary, I think, kept having moments when she wanted to gesture in a reassuring direction to sort of moderately minded people. She wanted to tout endorsements from various Republican Party figures, you know, who didn't like Trump. And then there would be kind of squeals from the left, like, oh my God, like, you're mainstreaming, you're rehabilitating all these neocons, you know. Or I remember something that's like, Hillary's going to run as the candidate of both parties' establishment with the backing of Goldman Sachs and the CIA, you know, somebody tweeted. And then her campaign would kind of loop back around, right, like to secure the base, right? And then would get itself into stuff like her big speech about the alt-right, you know, and like, you know, trying to take a firm stance in the kind of most interesting, you know, culture war kind of things happening. And it didn't work. And I think it didn't work in part. I mean, I think there's a sexism element, right? Where Biden, you know, quote unquote, looks the part. And we don't, people don't have, like, what Jennifer Palmieri says in her book, like, people don't have, like, a script in their head of, like, a woman as chief executive. And it just makes it challenging. Everything she does is subject to a heightened scrutiny. People are also just more freaked out about Trump, so they give Biden a little bit more leeway. But I also think that he won the primary in a way that was, in a interesting way, more respectful to his progressive rivals. Like, he just said that he didn't agree with them about some of their stuff. And then he got more votes and he won, right? He didn't do any of the stuff where he was like, no, I'm the real progressive in the race. He didn't do some of the stuff that Hillary's people did of trying to insinuate that it was like racist to like Bernie Sanders. And it left him with just like what the facts are, which is that if Biden wins the election, some of the stuff that left-wing people want to see happen will happen. And like some of it won't, because he's not one of, like, he's not their guy, but he does agree with them about some things. And they have just like a very, you know, Glenn Greenwald aside, I think like a pretty simpatico view of the world with the more left-wing people. And that has let him message, right? Like all of his ads are like so hyper-centrist, right? Like he wants disengaged people to be like, Joe Biden, I guess he believes in being a nice guy, right? Like they're really like out there. You know, in earned media, he's like not out there that aggressively. In paid media, I mean, Biden's run a bajillion ads and they're like, they're interesting and it's good creative, but he's like really trying to take the ideological edge off. But I think he can do that because he like feels his left flank is secure.
Yeah, let me add two things on that. So one, we should note there's just like a gender and race dynamic here. I was talking to the political scientist Yana Kryptnikov, and she's telling me about research she's done showing that people will give white male candidates, they're open to them being vague in a way they're not to women and non-white candidates. So it's like if a like white male candidate is like out there being like, yeah, we're gonna listen to some scientists and fix the coronavirus, people are like, okay, that sounds good. And then, you know, it's like with Hillary Clinton or Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren, you've got to get super specific on your plan, and that gives people things to attack. And so there just are things that Biden was able to do that you know, Hillary Clinton couldn't. For instance, there's this one incredibly, incredibly telling moment where Biden actually says during the, I think it's during the primary, I'm paraphrasing this, but it's functionally correct, says, you know, Hillary Clinton got treated really unfairly because she was a woman in the election. I'll tell you something, that's not going to happen with me. And it's like, he's right, but it's really grim. So that's one. The other thing I want to note is, I think there's like nobody more skeptical than me about Joe Biden's view of politics, that if you just have way better personal relationships with key actors, you can overcome a lot of ideological tensions. And whether or not that will work on the right, I still remain very skeptical with. But there is no doubt that it actually was very important on the left. So just Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have a much, 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 much better personal relationship than Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton did. And so while Bernie Sanders like did campaign for Hillary Clinton in 2016, like he was much more positive and like evidently warm towards Joe Biden. Like Biden reached out in a more distinct way and like created the Sanders Biden task forces. But, you know, Sanders has really like bear hugged Joe Biden ever since the primary. It has been clear they like each other. And that has been like this foundation for like a more serious coalitional strategy between like the Biden wing of the party and the Sanders wing of the party, in a way that I think reflects Joe Biden's view of politics, which is that you can work more easily to compromise and bridge ideological difference if you have like a strong grounding of personal relationship. And again, not my view of politics usually, and I think it like is not going to work with Mitch McConnell, but I got to give Biden credit on this one. Like, this is how he says it works, and more or less, like compared to some of what we've seen in the past, it worked.
Yep. All right, another break, and then our third topic.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, More than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So, you know, this is the weeds. We talk about the weedsy aspects of public policy from time to time. Been a lot of drama lately. But so this was our third question, was like the real weed stuff. Like, what's the topic you wish you had gotten to be more in the weeds on during these Trump years?
So I would say it's not just during the Trump years, also like predating Trump into the Obama years, but I have just come in my own ranking of issues by importance to think the U.S.-China relationship and the way we engage vis-a-vis China across like a host of issues, right? Everything from trade to climate to like geopolitical influence is one of the most existentially important questions in just policy and politics, full stop. It matters for a huge number of things. It matters tremendously for the economy. I think there's a case to be made that a better relationship on both sides would have made the coronavirus response faster. Maybe China would have been more honest at the beginning. Maybe we would have cooperated better from the beginning. And so I have not done as much work on US and China, and it's much harder for me. Like, obviously, my understanding of the Chinese political system is much weaker. And so, like, I just don't have as strong views as I would like to have on the correct way to handle some of the incredibly difficult parts of that relationship, from like the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs to everything, right? Like, I just don't know how to put everything together into a package. And this is a place where Trump has really changed both American foreign policy, but also America's foreign policy orientation in a dramatic way, in a way that has affected how the Democratic Party is also responding. There are a bunch of things where Donald Trump did something and Democrats like responded by doing the opposite or going further in the opposite direction, right? Democrats are more pro-immigration because of Donald Trump than they were before Donald Trump. Like, they responded thermostatically to Trump in that way. On China, the Democratic foreign policy establishment has become more China hawkish. Like, they have actually responded to Trump by somewhat co-opting his views on this, in part because a lot of them kind of agree there was a latent, somewhat suppressed view that China was becoming a worse and worse geopolitical actor and that what we were doing before wasn't working, that the neoliberal view that they would become a more small-d democratic and liberal society as they got richer, that wasn't quite panning out, but also just that some of the things we were trying to do with them just weren't functioning. Now, like, there were threads of this in the Obama administration too. Like, they believed in the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal very heavily as a way of containing Chinese influence in that region. And like, whether or not you agreed with that, like, that was something they thought was true. But just in general, I think it's easier for me to cover domestic policy. But I just think the U.S.-China relationship, if you ask me what's going to drive a lot of how well the next like 100 years turn out, whether or not we end up in a suspicious, difficult form of competition with the other rising superpower, or whether we find some ways to make cooperation possible, is really decisive. But I don't feel like I know how to do it in the way I feel like I know how to fix a healthcare system.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I mean, I'm always interested in the there's always a lot of continuity in American foreign policy relative to domestic policy across partisan transitions. And I don't think people saw Obama's second term this way. But now, like, looking back after Trump, I think we will say, well, OK, in Obama's second term, it turned out that the quote unquote pivot to Asia meant a reconfiguration of American foreign policy in an anti-Chinese direction, that the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which, you know, the content of TPP is like 95% like banal interest group politics, but the construction of that particular group of countries and the sales pitch of it was very much pitched as like the opening salvo in an anti-China economic competition. Trump then followed that in a different kind of way. Biden just this week, you know, he finally started giving an answer about tariffs and China, and he wouldn't use the words TPP, but like he was saying that like his critique of Trump's approach to this is that Trump didn't do enough like teaming up with allies to sort of like gang up on China in trade wise, which was the TPP concept. Right. So we see, you know, a real through line there. And I always find it hard to report on these issues because I find the realm of like experts in the foreign policy world to be very confusing. Like the actually like the lack of polarization on the topic to me always makes it like harder to read. You know, like people don't have, they don't draw lines as starkly. It's harder for me to get a sense of like what's the bottom line? Like what really drives this big picture disagreement? Whereas like I could tell you, like this is the conservative view of tax policy, this is the progressive view, here's where sort of centristy people, like what they accept, what they don't, and like why they sort the way they do. Foreign policy stuff always seems kind of opaque to me.
All right. Speaking of opaque, what do you wish you had spent more time covering?
Yeah. So I mean, I don't like I understand why I didn't do this. It's because the traffic would have been terrible. But I feel bad that I did not cover the unwinding of a lot of the regulation of Wall Street that was put in place after the financial crisis. I mean, I feel bad on one level because like I spent a lot of time covering that while it was being built up under the Obama years. And it just like feels like a waste to me personally to have like bothered to learn what FSOC is and what the supplemental leverage rule is, and then not done any articles about us kind of sliding back down the hill. But also because the nature of financial crises, as we know, is that no matter what you do, like no matter how bad your regulatory policy, in any given year, there probably won't be a banking crisis. But if you raise the odds from like, this is going to happen once every 1,000 years to once every 15 years, you've created a real problem. And I think that the Trump administration has in fact made the banking system much, much riskier. And the odds that that will be forcefully undone by a new administration seem a little bit low to me, just because it's like, it's hard to regulate an industry with obscure rules, unless the public is really geared up about it. And like, everyone was incredibly geared up in 2009, 2010. And like, now nobody cares, right? If I tried to like, you know, tell people about Randy Quarles, like, you know, it's like, no, nobody wants to read that. There's so much else going on. It's so tedious. But I think we're going to have a big problem here.
Yeah. So this is something that I have followed a bit, but I don't have a global view on it. When I talk to people in this, I have often been assured that we still have pretty good leverage requirements in, that one reason we're not seeing bigger problems is that like the capital cushions were strong. So how bad do you think the unwinding is? Because you saying this is making me think that I have underestimated. Like I knew some stuff was getting gutted, but I don't know. I've talked to economists during this because I was doing some reporting on the possibility of financial crises during coronavirus, and I mostly got more reassuring views that we are in better shape in large part because of these regulations. But you're suggesting maybe that's not true.
Well, the capital position of the banks is a lot stronger, right? So we headed into this, and I think a lot of us were like, oh, shit, I better like dust off my old banking experts and check in with them. And they were like, you know, no, Matt, like it's fine, right? Like the banks have more capital, which is true, right? And household balance sheets are healthier. But the rules have become a lot less binding. It's like what happened heading into the crisis is that all of the major banks actually were holding, I shouldn't say holding, the banks were being less risky than they were allowed to be, which was fine, right? Prudence sticks a certain number of years after a crisis. But we have let a number of big firms, so this was the so-called like non-bank systemically significant companies. A number of them have lost that designation. There was a legislation, like Crapo's bill, a bunch of the sort of bigger regional banks were let out of the highest level of regulatory scrutiny. A bunch of non-banks were let out of the highest level of regulatory scrutiny. The toughest set of rules was made weaker. So I actually think it's pretty bad, and it discomforts me that so many of my old friends from the Obama years who worked on these topics have headed out into the private sector, usually working in the financial services industry in some capacity, where, really not to be like mean about it, but I don't 100% trust their reassurances. Like, I remember when they were in government and they fought quite hard around these points, that now that they've been unwound, they're kind of like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. But they really fought for this stuff. Like, they fought for the non-bank systemically significant. They fought to keep the thresholds lower. They fought to raise the capital rules. And now we have a lot more vulnerabilities, I think, around the edges of the system. Now, if you assume Biden's going to come in and everybody he appoints is going to be like really good, they're going to be watching everybody like hawks, like, it's probably fine, right? The surveillance measures from Dodd-Frank so that the regulators can see more stuff, like, that's still all there. But you remember what's hard about dealing with bubbles is that somebody needs to like blow the whistle while things are going well. And that's just challenging. You know, like, it's really challenging for any set of regulators. And I think making the basic rules laxer is like really quite bad. I mean, I think they knew what they were doing the first time.
All right. Well, next time we do this, we're going to know a lot more than we do now. So,
well, we will have to see what happens. So thanks, Ezra. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. Oh, I should mention, there's going to be a special live Weeds on Tuesday that Vox supporters are invited to. There will also be an election on Tuesday, and then there will be more Weedses after the election when we hopefully have some idea what's going on. So we'll see you soon.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.